you everybody for joining. I'm very glad to see the screen on. It's always much better when I can see people. I'm recording audio. I am not recording video, in case anyone is concerned. I want to thank Shai Shamayim and the Bayit for partnering on this program, and the Nussbaum family in general for enabling these programs under the Nussbaum Family Medical Ethics and Halacha Institute. Just getting myself arranged here. I want to thank Barry Pacus for all of his work, both as a sounding board for me and for helping us to get CME credit through the University of Toronto. Barry, really appreciate it. Our next session is scheduled for Monday evening, February 13th, also 7:30 p.m., and the topic will be the Shoteh, Judaism and the Irrational Patient. And a lot's going to go into that, so we'll be talking about that. I'll be sending out a message via the medical email list with some of the topics I plan to address and asking you for your topics. There is a link on the source sheet, and as of 5 minutes ago, it's the correct link on the source sheet, for an evaluation. After the session, if you could please fill out the evaluation, that would be great. Even if you're not a medical professional, just skip the parts that are for professionals. This helps us get our accreditation from the University of Toronto. I gave you on the sheet the link for the evaluation, as well as a link to medical sessions from the Nussbaum Institute. You can look there at and see what we've already done, and send ideas for future classes. Please note, for anybody who wants to get CME credit, I do need you to sign in the chat, again via direct email to direct message to me or public. Either way works, but please make sure that you do that. So the topic for this evening, eating disorders in Judaism. It is a very large topic. Can't possibly cover all there is to say in our 90 minutes. But hopefully what we say will be helpful. If you look on the sheet, you'll see the agenda that we filed originally when we set up the class. A 2008 study, which I'll be referring to in a little bit, conducted in the GTA, suggested a higher prevalence of eating disorders among adolescent females in the Jewish community. It is certainly true that eating disorders are found in Jewish communities, including among those who observe Jewish law closely. Are there unique risk factors in observant Jewish lifestyles? How can the Jewish community mitigate this problem? And that's really our focus for the first part of the session this evening. And I'm a little skeptical about how far we're going to get to the other things, because that one is such a big issue, and I want to make sure to give it proper space. So we'll see how far we go in terms of our vignettes. Someone sent me a message asking whether the CME would work for a psychologist. The answer is yes in Toronto. If someone's outside of Canada, it'll work in Canada. I'm not sure what will happen outside of Canada. Okay. I gave you on the sheet, in addition to the links for the evaluation and for past medical sessions, I gave you links for 5 other recordings that are available on YU Torah, that I recommend. Number one, there was a plenary session in 2010 involving Dr. Esther Altman, Rabbi David Goldwasser, and Dr. Karen Rosewater, on eating disorders in the Jewish community. Then there are 2 from Rabbi Larry Rothwax, who is not, a doctor, but he has gained a lot of experience and knowledge in the area of eating disorders. One of the sessions is on prevention, detection, and treatment, and the other is on what every parent and educator needs to know. Then there's a link for a panel we did at Shari Shamayim in 2017 with Dr. Raul Strauss of Mayanei HaYeshua in Israel, Dr. Liora Pinchas, who was an author on that 2008 study in the GTA, and I was on the panel as well. And that's available on YU Torah. And then the last one is a session that we did in this series in 2019, and that was the link on there is incorrect. That's interesting. It's on mental health and mitzvot, but it's not going to be there. But if you go to YU Torah and you search for mental health and mitzvot, you'll find it. Maybe when I send out the follow-up email from this session, I'll include a corrected source sheet with the right link for that. This is what happens when you do that on an airplane. there were worse problems that came up. But nonetheless, I also want to give a lot of credit to a book that came out last year, which was immensely helpful for me. You know, some of you may be aware that that for years I was talking about trying to write a book on mental health and halacha, and I never found the time to properly write it. I devoted some time, it didn't, whatever. And then Rabbi Yonatan Rosenzweig and Dr. Samuel Harris in Israel came out with a sefer which really is fantastic. I'm going to show it to you here on the screen. It's called Nafshi B'She'elati. It's in Hebrew, although I'm told that there's an English edition in the works. I don't know what the story is with it. But it is on all sorts of mental health issues beyond eating disorders. And what I really like about it is, number one, the organization of it. The information is presented very clearly, very well. And number two, the fact that the authors actually approached leading halachic authorities of our time with practical questions and got the leading authorities to answer on the record. So sometimes you'll see in a book, you know, rabbis say, or I asked a particular leading figure. In this case, the answers come with the names attached of who gives those answers, and that is, that's not something I can find elsewhere, and it's really a wonderful gift, and you'll see I'm going to be quoting it, during the session. And no, there are no commissions for me on the sales of the book, just to be clear, with the University of Toronto. Okay. Nothing I say in this session should be construed as psak, as a halachic ruling, especially because assessing cases and determining treatments really, really difficult and very case specific. Each case is really its own question. Some of the challenges in assessing cases from a halachic perspective include the fact that a lot of the diagnosis is based on self-reporting, which, you know, halacha has difficulty working with. The potential impacts of eating disorders on a patient are wide-ranging, and you really need to be an expert in order to know how to read where things could go and what, you know, how severe something is. There are evidence-based treatment paths, but applying them to particular cases requires an experienced professional who knows the case really well. I also brought you on the sheet, it's source number one on the sheet, a thought from Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook. He was dealing with a seizure disorder, and his discussion is not directly about eating disorders, but he was approached regarding the ability of a man to marry another wife because his wife had a seizure disorder, and it created complications in terms of his ability to divorce her. And I'm not really going into source number one. My point in bringing it was just to say that Rabbi Cook says, you know, it's really, really hard to evaluate the health of the patient in this case, physical health and mental health. And so he declines to take the initiative that has been proposed to him in a letter that was sent to him, because he says, I don't think that I could properly assess it. And that's really true when you're dealing with a lot of mental health issues, as we are with the eating disorders discussion. We do have a path in Jewish law for dealing with unknowns and unknowables. So in a very different realm, Professor Moshe Halbertal in source number two talks about the fact that we have unknowables when it comes to something as basic as determining day and night. In Jewish law, there is a period of time in the evening called Bein Hashmashot in Hebrew, between the suns, and it's unclear if that is the status of day or the status of night. And Jewish law finds a way to deal with that period of time because you have to be able to deal with uncertainty. And the same thing is true when it comes to health issues where we are uncertain and where we often can't know things precisely. I can't project the trajectory of an illness with 100% certainty. So what do we do? I brought it for you in source number 3, a major principle which we're going to invoke quite a bit. The passage in the Talmud in Yuma, they're dealing there with the question of fasting on Yom Kippur for somebody who is ill. And they say, v'safek nefashos lahakil. If you're not sure when it comes to saving lives, you rule leniently. It's actually there a discussion also about unearthing somebody from a ruin on Shabbos. So there are unknowns and there are unknowables in the area of eating disorders from a halachic perspective, but we have a system for approaching them. And so what we need to do is make sure that individual cases are actually dealt with case by case with case-specific analysis and consultation with both medical professionals and rabbis. So that's my opening note, which I think is just, you know, really important to mention. I brought you vignettes on the sheet, which, you know, they're after source number 4, but I'm not going to read them out just yet. First of all, I want to note source number 4, and this is from the introduction to a paper, Disordered Eating in Jewish Adolescent Girls, from the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry. This is the 2008 study that I mentioned earlier. So the method for this study, high school students, 868 of them, from the Toronto area, completed a demographic and religious practice questionnaire together with the eating attitudes test, a self-report test that discriminated adolescents with syndromal eating disorders from normal adolescents. So 868 high school students, Jewish, not Jewish, wide range. If anybody doesn't have the source sheet, I put the link in the chat again for it. I see a hand up, but I'm not going to take it just yet. The results. Jewish females aged 13 to 20 years, but not males, reported significantly more disordered eating behaviors and attitudes compared with their non-Jewish female counterparts. 25% of Jewish females, as compared with 18% of non-Jewish females, scored above the clinical cutoff for this eating attitudes test. No differences in vulnerability to disordered eating were found within the group of Jewish females or males related to their degree of religious observance. So it wasn't about religious observance, but they found a higher rate among Jewish females than among non-Jewish females. And so that's what drives a lot of my interest in presenting this session. And the first vignette, if you flip the page, which is simple. What should doctors be aware of in terms of the potential influence Judaism and the Jewish community have on the development and mitigation of eating disorders? That's our opening question. Yeah, Gerard, your hand is up. I can't hear you. Okay, I'm going to go with the assumption that that's an accident. Okay, so that's the first piece that we're gonna want to address. Then we'll get to certain other questions that follow from there. But that's our starting point. One thing that I'm not really going to discuss much, but I want to make sure that I note that it exists, are treatment modalities, therapies. I worry a bit that excluding that is going to make it sound like all is lost, and God forbid that is absolutely not true. There are effective evidence-based treatments, and we'll see some of the statistics on the way that can improve things for patients. And I gave you a link in number 5 for a website where some of those therapies are described. But let's start by asking the following question. What are eating disorders? I've used it in the title. What exactly is an eating disorder? So I'm going to present some information first, but I'm going to ask the professionals to please correct me if I'm getting something wrong. So the following, again, is not comprehensive. I want to bring out certain particular points. First of all, normal eating, eating that's not from an eating disorder, is largely unthinking. We eat because of a physiological need. We may also enjoy the taste, the company of other people with whom we eat, tangential factors, but fundamentally we eat because our body needs food. Much of the imperative is unconscious, regulated by hormones. Nutritional intake happens subconsciously. We're wired to get the nutrition that we need. If there's a disruption in the schedule, there's a fast day, there's a major feast, we deal with it and we move on. It doesn't cause havoc in our physiological systems or in our psychological systems. Then there's something called disordered eating. Disordered eating means something that is maladaptive. It may be bad for you, but it's not an eating disorder. Picky eating would be an example of that. Picky eating, where it's a function of, I like this food, I don't like that food, may be bad for you if you decide that you don't like vegetables, as an example. But so long as it doesn't reach the point where it endangers health, it's not an eating disorder. Somebody who eats because of an emotional state. I'm nervous. I'm sad. So, again, that may be maladaptive, but if it doesn't endanger health, it's not an eating disorder. Unhealthy dieting to reach a particular weight may also be bad for you, but again, if it has a rational process to it that reflects reality, someone says, I'm just making up numbers. Someone says, I am 240 pounds and I want to be 210 pounds. And they diet in an unhealthy way to reach that point, but they have a very realistic understanding of what the numbers are and what they look like. So again, it's not going to be called an eating disorder. Then you get the eating disorders. And I'm going to spend some time on the two major best-known eating disorders, anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa. Both of these are understood to be driven by psychological/emotional issues, often said to be around exerting control. And they involve conscious actions, eating or restricting eating, in order to satisfy a psychological, emotional need. So instead of appetite being something that's regulated by hormones, it's regulated by conscious input and it's controlled by will. I have decided this is what I'm going to do. Portion control is severely compromised. Nutritional intake is severely compromised. Let's talk anorexia specifically. In anorexia, there is, by the way, if you're tracking on the source sheet, we're now at number 8. In anorexia, there is a potent fear of gaining weight, understood to be driven, again, by an emotional need, a psychological need, like lack of control. The disorder is thought to be rooted in a desire for control, but the patient feels it as an irrational fear of becoming overweight, with a distorted body image telling them that they are overweight. And so the patient tries to lose weight by not eating, by burning calories, and by purging, getting rid of food that they have eaten. So the behaviors will include obsession with calories, fat, nutrition information, frequent weighing, exercise to burn calories, purging after they eat, pretending to eat or giving excuses for not eating, eating in a very controlled, even ritualistic way, and refusing to eat around other people. Those are some of the behaviors that are associated with anorexia. Then let's talk about bulimia. So in the case of bulimia, there is a potent desire to eat, but to avoid gaining weight. And this also is understood to be driven by psychological/emotional needs like lack of control. Even though the disorder is thought to be rooted in a desire for control or some other emotional need, the patient feels an irrational need. I have to eat and I have to maintain weight. And so they get into a cycle of overeating, followed by guilt, which brings on exercise and purging the food they ate. And it happens, if you're talking about a clinical diagnosis of bulimia, it's happening several times per week. It could be daily or more, for a period of time. In other words, it isn't just somebody did this once and now we call them bulimic. It's a pattern over time, and it's not just experimenting. The behaviors, and here we're at source number 9, include eating large amounts, using diet pills, laxatives, other diuretics to maintain the weight that they want, throwing up after eating, disappearing after meals, often to the bathroom or shower in order to get rid of the food, compulsive exercise that completely ignores injuries or bad weather, keeping short fingernails to avoid hurting themselves when they are purging, social withdrawal, fatigue. There are other eating disorders besides these two, even though these two are the best known. There's binge eating. There is ARFID. I gave you this on the sheet in 10, 11, and 12. There's binge eating disorder, different from bulimia primarily in that there's no purging going on. There's ARFID, avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. And then there's something called other specified feeding or eating disorder in the DSM-5. I gave you the example of night eating syndrome as one example of that in source number 12. I'm not spending a lot of time on it, but I wanted to acknowledge that it isn't just about anorexia and bulimia. So that's a basic introduction to key elements of eating disorders. There's a lot left out necessarily. I'm going to pause now and ask the experts, is there anything that either is just wrong or that should be added here to this conversation? Oh, come on. There are 77 screens here. Someone's got to disagree with me.
Such a good job. We've got nothing to disagree with.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Then let's go a little further. Esther, you were going to say? Nope. Okay. So how does halacha, how does Jewish law evaluate eating disorders? We have a halachic system with a set of obligations, both in terms of do's and in terms of don'ts, that are overridden in certain cases, in certain health circumstances. How does halacha evaluate eating disorders? So in general, outside of the framework of eating disorders, halacha looks a lot at danger. And it looks at immediate danger, and it looks at long-term threats as well. And it also looks at pain as being significant to the halacha calculation. So when it comes to immediate risks, we have the category of chole sheyesh bo sakana, somebody who is ill and they are dangerously ill, and for that we will override almost anything in order to protect the life of somebody who is in fact dangerously ill. We also have a category called chole she'ein bo sakana, somebody who is ill and their life is not currently under threat. They're not functioning right now because of their illness, but they're going to live. That category can also include somebody who has experienced what is called in Hebrew tsa'ar gadol, great pain. They're included in this as well. And for someone like that, we will override rabbinic prohibitions. I brought for you on the sheet source number 13, Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch. I'm reading out my English translation, but you see the Hebrew there as well. He's talking about the laws of Shabbos, and he says, for one who is bedridden from illness, but not endangered, and Rabbi Moshe Isserles adds there in the Shulchan Aruch, one who is in such pain that his whole body is ill, even if he can walk, he is like one who is bedridden, somebody who's in a lot of pain. In such a circumstance on Shabbos, if I can't take care of them because of Shabbos, so I should tell a non-Jew to do it, even though I'm not allowed rabbinically to tell someone who isn't Jewish to do things on Shabbos that I'm not allowed to do. In this case, you can. So you would override rabbinic prohibitions for such a circumstance. Also, outside of the realm of Shabbos, somebody who is in a category of chole she'ein bo sakana, they're not dangerously ill, but they're not functioning, or is in a category of being in great pain, is exempt from mitzvot that would prevent them from being healed. If a mitzvah would interfere with their healing, they are exempt. So if you take a look at source number 14, that's my first excerpt taken from Rabbi Rosenzweig's book, Nafshi B'Sheilati, my translation in number 14. As has been stated, one who is in great pain, his status is like that of someone whose aver is endangered, where a body part is endangered. There is no doubt that all rabbinic prohibitions are overridden for one who is in great pain, even without any shinui. You don't need to do whatever action you're doing in an unusual way. Likewise, one is not obligated to fulfill any commandment which would present an obstacle to complete healing. That's going to become very important when we discuss issues like whether an anorexic should be eating matzah on Pesach. Hopefully we'll get to that discussion later. So if you're dealing with somebody who is either dangerously ill, you're going to override certain laws, basically almost all. If you're dealing with somebody who is not facing a threat to life, but on the other hand, they're not functioning or they're in great pain, we will override rabbinic law. We also pay attention to pending threats, threats which are not there at the moment, but could develop over the long term. And we treat them as a real threat now. You could have a situation in which somebody right now is not healthy, we wouldn't be having this conversation, but they're not facing a threat now, but they could be down the line if things progress. And here you have in source number 15, the classic quote from the Briska Rav, Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik. You see my translation there. Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, the Briska Rav, told a doctor that saving a life is not specifically the case of someone who is now dangerously ill and will die. Even where the fast, he's talking about fasting on Yom Kippur, will affect this person years later when the disease will recur. And so fasting now will cause him to die early. In other words, fasting could lead to a recurrence later on. This is saving a life. He is required to eat. We are concerned about risks coming down the line. Some of you were there when we gave our session on CPAP machines. And we talked then about the weight of potential harm to somebody in the future. Halachic authorities are concerned about going too far when you're dealing with potential long-term harm, and they don't want to view it quite the same way as immediate harm. Nonetheless, it certainly has halachic weight. So when you're talking about a condition which is dangerous now or could become dangerous down the line, we take it very seriously in Jewish law. Add in the concern that we have for suicidal ideation. We have a principle which we've discussed on other occasions that we save people from death, from great harm on Shabbos. We save them in particular from death on Shabbos, even if that death would come about because of their own actions. If there is somebody who attempted suicide on Shabbos, we absolutely violate Shabbos in order to save them, just like we would do in order to save somebody else. We weigh that as a life-threatening circumstance, and we act to save them. And therefore, if we're talking about a situation in which somebody, because of their condition, could have suicidal thoughts, we will act in order to save them, even in violation of, let's say, the laws of Shabbos. I'll give you an example. If you take a look at source number 16, this again is from that book, Nafshi B'She'elati, my English translation. Frequently, it happens that if the mind is not distracted by external stimuli, suicidal thoughts settle in and draw the person to terrible deeds. He's not talking about eating disorders per se. He's talking about mental illness of a variety of kinds. In such cases, there is concern for danger to life. So, for example, those who suffer from anorexia, our specific case, may be permitted for this reason, where there is concern for suicidal thoughts or thoughts that can lead there. They may be allowed to engage in actions on Shabbos that will distract them. And so ruled Rabbi Eliezer Melamed, a major authority in Jewish law in Israel, author of the Pnine Halacha, on the word of a God-fearing mitzvah-observing doctor. Some of you may recall, we've discussed the question of which, you know, who you would consult on issues like this in order to justify breaking Shabbos. You want somebody who's going to take Shabbos seriously. So a very specific example, take a look at number 17. Writing or drawing are biblically prohibited melachot, acts that are not supposed to be performed on Shabbos. So they are not permitted on Shabbos unless they aid in some way the therapeutic process of a patient who is dangerously ill. So, for example, there are cases of people with suicidal inclinations, not only passing suicidal thoughts, like those who suffer from anorexia, for whom this phenomenon is known, that only writing or drawing will push aside these thoughts. For them, writing or drawing are included in life-saving activities. So that is another facet of the dangers and dealing with the dangers that are involved. You know, I'm torn regarding discussing the kinds of risk and levels of mortality that are involved with eating disorder, because I don't want to add stigma and I don't want to make it seem hopeless. But I think it's irresponsible if I omit it. I mean, this is the crux of the issue.
You mention it.
Right.
I think it's critically important to mention the incidence.
Thank you. But I do want to refer back to source number 5, the link for therapies. I want to make sure that we're clear. There are evidence-based effective treatments that are available. So this is the big picture statement about how halacha weighs danger. We are concerned for immediate danger. Whether it's a threat to life or not a threat to life will determine the weight that halacha assigns to it. We are concerned about great pain. We are concerned about suicidal ideation. Let's apply this now to eating disorders and the risks that are involved. And here we're up to number 18 on the source sheet. Okay, I'm not going too quickly, right? I hope. Okay.
Can I just say one thing about number 18?
No, because I didn't get to it yet. After I get to it, then I'm going to ask for comment. So first of all, anorexia. Anorexia can certainly be a case of life-threatening illness. Malnutrition itself causes a range of other physiological problems, and I gave you a list in number 18. I'm not a doctor. I'm just giving you what I've read. Dehydration, low blood sugar, low sodium, fainting, GI issues, osteoporosis, hair loss, cognitive impairments, suppressed immune system, cardiac and blood pressure issues, problems with fertility, as well as pregnancy. Worth noting, this was a comment I saw in an article by Usher Shikani in the journal Asya, which is a medical journal in Israel. It's source number 19, my translation. He points out death can be sudden and not necessarily tied to being underweight. Mostly mortality is caused by infection, cardiac arrhythmia, or imbalance of salts and minerals in the body. Some patients will die of suicide. And the point that he's trying to make is, God forbid for somebody to say, well, you know what, we're monitoring them. And, you know, we'll see if anything is getting to a point of being dangerous. There's no such thing. It doesn't work that way. It can happen, and it can be unexpected. And as he notes, anorexia may be associated with depression and anxiety, which carry their own risks, including suicidal ideation. So I wanted to provide some statistics here. Statistics Canada is working from 2012 information. It's 10 years old, but it's the most recent that I was able to find available online. And you see it here. This is taken off of their website. Anorexia nervosa affects between 0.3% and 1% of women. So could be 3 out of 1,000, could be 10 out of 1,000. Onset is typically in mid to late adolescence, with behavior likely beginning as innocent dieting. Gradually, weight loss becomes an obsession and progresses to extreme and unhealthy weight loss. Suicide attempts occur in about 20 to 30% of subjects. Now, you notice the reference to women. As we're going to discuss, it is more prevalent in women than men, but you should know it exists in men as well. I'm going to come back to that point in a little bit. Information from the United States. So a 2007 study asked of over 9,000 English-speaking Americans about a variety of mental health conditions, including eating disorders. The results found 0.9% of women, 0.3% of men had anorexia during their life. Males are at a higher risk of dying. This was the point that I wanted to come back to. Males are at a higher risk. Males who have anorexia are at a higher risk of dying than females who have it. In part because they are often diagnosed later, since many people assume males don't have eating disorders. So they'll write it off to something else and miss what's going on. Anorexia has a mortality rate of around 10%, they say here. 1 in 5 of those deaths is from suicide. Rabbi Shikani, in his article, actually has an interesting nuance. He says, In the untreated population, it's 20 to 30%. In the treated population, 5%, which tells you something about the fact that treatment matters. Detection and treatment matter. And then they point out, still in number 21, a Swedish study of 6,000 women who were treated for anorexia found that over 30 years, women with anorexia had a six-fold increase in mortality compared to the general population. The researchers also found an increased mortality rate from natural causes, such as cancer, compared to the general population. The younger they are, the longer their initial hospitalization, the better the outcome. But comorbid conditions like alcohol addiction will make the outcome worse. That's anorexia. Bulimia. Bulimia can also be a case of chole sheyesh bo sakana, a case of dangerous illness. It doesn't have to be, and often it is not. I say it's more likely just because in studies that I saw, and I was going to bring them on here and just said, you know what, at a certain point, you got over 50 sources, just leave it. But they, there was, in 2016, there was a study called Mortality and Eating Disorders, it was in the International Journal of Eating Disorders, and they said bulimia is less fatal than anorexia. Nonetheless, there are real short-term and long-term threats to life, ranging from, and here in source number 22, I listed it, due to purging, tears in the esophagus and the general digestive system, acid reflux from all the vomiting, low potassium and metabolic issues, pancreatitis, and cavities because of the damage done to the enamel on teeth. Then you have secondary problems, like because they use diuretics, that leads to dehydration and all the problems that can come from dehydration, heart problems, electrolyte imbalance. They may have weight gain related problems depending on what they're doing to try to maintain their weight. I see the hand. I'm going to take comments in a minute. There's a possibility, longer term, that a bulimic actually becomes anorexic. I read a meta-analysis of 36 studies in the Archives of General Psychiatry where they talked about the prevalence of people who are bulimic becoming anorexic. Bulimia also may be associated with depression and anxiety, which carry their own risks, including suicidal ideation. And then I brought you 23 and 24. 23 is statistics. Canada, and 24 is from the U.S., from the National Eating Disorders Association, bulimia is more prevalent than anorexia. Whereas with anorexia, you were talking about 3 to 10 per 1,000, approximately 1 to 3% of young women in Canada develop bulimia in their lifetime. In the U.S. one, that 2007 study of more than 9,000, they found 1% of women and 0.5% of men had bulimia at some point during their life. It's an incredible amount. Okay, I'm pausing there, for questions and comments. Rose, you were going to say something, before about the list of risks.
So the one thing, when I look at the list, it's very comprehensive, but in my head, I always think of things as acute or chronic.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to divide. Well, you have definitely said it. In terms of the long-term survival, if you're anorexic and in the adolescent years, it doesn't go away. So you could still manifest those things later on in life. And I guess that maybe speaks to, I read 10%, death rate, the incidence of death is 10% at about 10 years,
right.
And 20% at 20 years. So although it could be physiological long-term damage, it could also be that those people it keeps recurring.
Right.
They have this long-term damage.
Right. No, thank you. It's true. And that's where treatment and monitoring are so important. Susan.
First of all, I'm so impressed with you because you're not a eating disorders expert and you have to go into this incredibly complex field. The only thing that I wanted to just add to it, at the Academy of Eating Disorders conference, one of the big workshops was about looking at behaviors more than diagnoses, because many of the clients that struggle with disordered eating are going to have very much these symptoms that are very problematic medically and psychologically. So they're looking at binging, restricting, selective eating, and purging rather than the diagnoses, which I think is a really important thing because the diagnoses, you know, if you see a patient or a congregant who's not got a diagnosis, you might think that there is not a problem. The other thing that I just wanted to mention is that the very big high-risk new area that's being investigated when we're looking at, because the obvious lifespan we know is puberty and teenagers, but really midlife and specifically perimenopause, not postmenopause and not premenopause, but perimenopause, you're seeing similar hormone issues and changes in the body, and that's a huge area of focus right now that is understudied. So I just think about our population where women are no longer, you know, have got, in more religious communities, have may not have as much of a function. If they're no longer in their fertile years, this is actually a very high-risk time for new eating disorders, not necessarily...
Thank you.
Last comment. So just wanted to...
Yeah, no, thank you for mentioning that. That's really important, and I was not aware of that. Thank you. Other questions and comments on what we've said so far? Okay. So in terms of the issue of danger to health, we've covered how halacha deals with danger to health and recognizes and values it, and we've seen the evidence of it regarding the anorexic, regarding the bulimic. But there's also another area in halacha which is very important in this regard, and that is the area of irrationality and the state of being, what's called a shote. And this is something we're going to discuss at greater length in the session that's coming up on February 13th, but it's very relevant here. Labeling somebody a shote, irrational, in Jewish law, is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, just realized I left something out that I'm going to get to, so I just want to make a note for myself. Okay. On the one hand, calling somebody a shote in Jewish law is a chumrah. It places restrictions on them because it means that they are not able to engage in transactions, including potentially marriage and divorce. That was Rabbi Cook's situation in source number one. On the other hand, it is a kula. It is a leniency. I'm just going to mute people by default because I'm getting a little background noise. The number one, it means that somebody is not obligated in commandments and is exempt for violation of prohibitions. If they are a shote, if they are not rational, then these mitzvot are not incumbent upon them. Also, curing somebody from shote status is an act of saving a life because you restore to them, aside from any risks involved from being a shote, separate from that, you restore to them their Judaism. If you take a look at source number 25, a response of Rabbi Usher Weiss, dealing with treatment for somebody who is suffering from OCD, I believe was his case. This is somebody who, because of the anxieties associated with OCD, feels like he doesn't pronounce brachot, blessings, properly. And take a look at what he has to say. Doctors who are expert in this field, this is my translation, believe that the way to treat it is that he never repeat any statement or prayer. In other words, he's praying, he's saying a blessing, he should not go back and say it again because he thinks he didn't say it right. You say it once, and you move on. When it is clear as the sun to him that he has not said the name properly, and he has not fulfilled his duty in his bracha and his blessing, may he eat. That's the question that the patient asks. You're telling me I can only say the blessing once, but I know I said it wrong. Am I allowed to now eat? I know I said it wrong. So Rabbi Weiss, as part of his response, says the following. Even if we would say that one may not violate a prohibition for medical purposes, let's say you said medical purposes was not sufficient grounds, our case would still be different. For if he would not be healed and freed from his crisis, he would violate these mitzvot forever. This is not a shote situation, just to clarify. This isn't saying that somebody with OCD is classified as a shote. But the point is, this person in his illness is not able to properly pray, properly recite blessings. He has to be healed from that. In any such case, we say better to desecrate one Shabbat and not desecrate many Shabbatot, meaning cure him now and he'll be able to recite blessings and pray properly in the future. So if the price is sacrifice the blessing now, say it once and eat and don't repeat it. And even if you got it wrong, don't go back, because this will enable you to do it better in the future. That's worthwhile. He says this precious person may cancel blessings and Shema in order to be healed so that he will be able to fulfill these mitzvot properly. The point is, you can treat somebody now, you will restore to them proper function in the future, including proper religious function. And the same thing applies and is brought by halachic authorities regarding somebody who is classified as irrational. If you can restore them to mental health, to emotional health, you will be enabling them to live a good Jewish life in the future. That's the argument. Now, in the case of eating disorders, we've already noted there is some level of irrationality surrounding weight and surrounding eating. I'm now focusing on anorexia. So they don't have a good sense of what their weight is and what is healthy. And that's what's driving this. Could that cause them to be labeled a shoteh? So take a look at source number 26. Source number 26 is the principal place in the Babylonian Talmud that discusses what qualifies somebody as a shoteh. Who is a shoteh? One who travels alone at night and who sleeps in a cemetery and who tears his clothing. Okay, someone who walks around alone at night, sleeps in a cemetery, and tears his clothing. Rav Huna, one of the sages from the time of the Gemara, says, one who displays all of these at once. It's got to be all three criteria. Rabbi Yochanan said, no, even one of these behaviors. So the Talmud says, wait, what are we talking about? If he's acting apparently irrationally, he is walking around alone at night in a dangerous area with no justification whatsoever. He's just doing it. Then even that should suffice. Even one action should be enough to render this person a shoteh. And if he does not act irrationally, if he's not doing it irrationally, he's going from his house to somebody else's house because somebody needs him. He got called and he needs to go. So then even all of these acts would not suffice. So the answer is, we're talking about where we don't know what's behind it. Where he acts apparently irrationally, but one could explain each symptom in a rational way. And the Talmud goes through different ways to explain why one might do these different things. Once he performs all of them, it's like an animal that gores an ox, a donkey, and a camel. It is now identified as dangerous for all of them. You've established a pattern. That's the idea in these symptoms. We're then told that Rav Huna, who was the one who said you have to perform all of them, right? Rav Huna was the one who said if you display all these symptoms. Rav Papa said, had Rav Huna heard the following lesson, who is a shoteh? One who destroys that which people give him. He would have recanted. He would have said, oh yeah, that's it. That's what defines someone as a shoteh. They destroy their property. So they ask, does that mean that Rav Huna would have recanted from listing the trait of tearing his clothing because it's similar? Or he would have recanted from all of them? What exactly do you mean that he would have recanted? And that remains unclarified. Now, that is a lot of back and forth. We have a list of three. We are told that that may be the exclusive list, or there may be... maybe you have to do all three. Maybe it's enough with even one, depending on how one does it. The Jerusalem Talmud is much more concise in source number 27. It just says the signs of a shoteh are one who goes about at night, one who sleeps in the cemetery, one who tears his clothes, and one who destroys that which is given to him. What is all of this about? What are all these symptoms about? So there's a work called Or Yesharim, in which Rabbi Moshe Natan Kahana Shapira is brought, and he says the following in number 28, and this I saw referenced in Nafshi B'Sheilati, I wasn't familiar with it myself. He says, the sign, what we're really talking about in identifying the sign of a shoteh, is that he lacks the intellect to protect himself, meaning his body, life, or property. Therefore, one who goes out alone at night, which rational people fear to do lest they be physically harmed, one who lies down in the cemetery where people fear for their lives, lest a spirit of tum'ah cleave to them, and obviously that's something that changes over time, but in the Talmudic world, that's a fear for them, and one who tears his clothing, destroying his property, as well as not caring about his dignity. We're talking about people who do not display the basic instinct of wanting to protect themselves, their safety, their property, their dignity from harm. So then we have to ask two questions. What is the bottom line if somebody only displays a single symptom? We have a debate between Rav Huna and Rabbi Yochanan. What's the rule? And what if somebody displays symptoms that aren't listed here? As in the example of an anorexic, right? The anorexic is not eating what they need in order to be healthy. That wasn't on the list, but it's clearly an act in which one is not looking out for one's own safety. So many halachic authorities rule that one is considered a shoteh for even one symptom that isn't on this list. So take a look, please, at number 30. Source number 29 I'm going to come back to. But take a look at source number 30 and the Shulchan Aruch. This is lifted by the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, from the Rambam, who said it earlier. A shoteh is disqualified from testifying in court. This is not only a shoteh who wanders without clothing and breaks implements and throws stones, but anyone whose mind is torn so that his mind is confused perpetually on some matter. Even though he speaks and inquires on point in other areas, he is disqualified and considered a shoteh. So the Shulchan Aruch says, even one symptom, but performed regularly, right, perpetually, is enough to render a person a shoteh. And this is brought in many halachic authorities. Example, source number 31, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, the rabbi in Novardok, in the beginning of the 20th century. He says in source number 31, acting in an irrational manner is when one does this many times, but doing it once or twice does not cause us to consider him a shoteh for this. And the Rambam believed that the Talmud's list is not specific. And the same applies if we see someone whose mind is perpetually confused on some matter, doing something which those who are whole in their minds would not do. Such a person is considered a shoteh. And there are great authorities who believe that shoteh is only that which is stated in the Talmud as we have written, but their position has been rejected by all of the authorities. The Tur, Rabbi Yaakov, author of the Tur, also agreed with the Rambam, and it appears to me that even these great authorities agree with the Rambam, but believe that since this person is not a shoteh in other areas, it is hard for us to establish he's performing this action in an irrational manner or not. His point is he thinks everybody would agree that doesn't have to be on the list. It's just that it's hard to figure out. So what does count and what does not count? But not being on the list isn't the key point. Clear? We have a list in the Talmud. Halachic authorities believe that those are examples. Those are not the exclusive list of what renders somebody a shoteh. By the way, I see a lot of screens have turned off. If people, at least some can turn them back on, that would be great. It's a lot more fun for me when I can see people. Maybe fun is the wrong word for this class, but you know what I mean. So even though we have now expanded the list of traits that will make somebody a shoteh, we still are very careful not to expand it too much. So as an example of that, if you take a look at source number 32, Rabbi Ephraim Zalman Margolios, from his Beis Ephraim, he says, we have seen many times in the Talmud that it calls someone a shoteh because he says one irrational thing. But still, he doesn't have the status of a shota. The Talmud will use the word shota loosely sometimes. He's called this as a figure of speech, borrowed for the occasion. Even if he performs an act of irrationality, such that they call him a shota, that doesn't cause him to have the actual status of a shota. And he gives you an example of it from a passage in the Gemara in Chulin, which isn't directly relevant for us. So I brought the Hebrew, but I didn't translate it there. But the fact that the Talmud calls somebody shota, not all shotim are created equal, so to speak. That's number one. Number two, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, and here I take you back to source number 29. If you take a look at source number 29, you'll, Rabbi Feinstein there, sorry. He says, he's dealing with a case in which a man declares himself to be Mashiach. He's the Messiah. And he's doing things like, if I remember correctly, hanging out in trees without clothing on and, you know, declaring to the world that he is the Messiah. And, you know, what he's doing isn't on the list. And the question now becomes, is he capable in Jewish law of divorcing his wife? Or is his wife stuck with him? That's the question. Is he able to divorce his wife? So Rabbi Feinstein says, yes, he doesn't qualify as irrational. He says, one could argue further that also all of his foolish actions, which emerge from his error that he is Mashiach, that according to his bad thought, he is repairing the world, these do not render him a shoteh for all matters. One who acts according to a certain logic and path that he believes, even if it is great foolishness, is not considered a shoteh for this. How do you like that one? He saved the girl, but like, you know, it's very hard to understand why it is that this person is not a shoteh, but we really try to avoid applying shoteh too far. One more note, and then I'm gonna call for questions and comments to hopefully clarify what we've been saying. And that is, not all areas of law have the same status in terms of what defines somebody as a shoteh. Rabbi Yisr Zalman Meltzer made this point in source number 33. You may have noticed the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch when they said, if somebody is irrational perpetually about one thing, that makes them a shoteh in general. He did that in the context of the laws of testimony. Maybe the standards for testimony are different from the standards of other areas of Jewish law. And that's Rabbi Yisr Zalman Meltzer's suggestion. And it makes a lot of sense. He says, one may suggest that the Rambam's novel lesson that one who is confused on some specific matter is disqualified from testimony, for he is not obligated in mitzvot, that's specifically regarding mitzvot, where the Torah requires a person to be whole in order to be obligated. Maybe for mitzvot, if you're irrational on some point, you're now not obligated in mitzvot, period. But regarding transactions and even divorce and marriage, if his mind is confused on one matter, which has nothing to do with the transaction or divorce or marriage, one cannot prove that his action is void. Maybe that doesn't take him out of the category altogether. That would be really remarkable, because remember what I said. Shoteh is a leniency when it comes to exempting somebody from mitzvot. It is a stringency when it comes to disqualifying them from transactions. But now, Rabbi Yisr Zalman Meltzer is floating the idea that maybe we have a lower bar when it comes to mitzvot, and a higher bar when it comes to transactions and to marriages. That would be a very interesting split. So to sum up in one sentence what we've said in this last unit, and then we'll be ready to talk about our vignettes, there are two halachic reasons to view an eating disorder as overriding Jewish law concerns. Number one, it's dangerous, and danger includes life-threatening, non-life-threatening but disabling, and causing great pain, as well as the risk of suicide. And number two, the issue of being a shoteh, being labeled irrational, which will exempt them from mitzvot, creating a situation in which they cannot fulfill mitzvot, and therefore they're not obligated in them. Questions and comments on that? No, we're still good? Yes, Albert, Dr. Kirshen.
It's interesting, but when you think about legal capacity, which is what you're really talking about,
yeah,
it's for the task at the time.
Right. So from
that's what Rav Feinstein is saying.
Right. So from a secular legal perspective, that is entirely true. And there are different standards of incapacity for different actions. And as you note, a person can be considered incapable in one area of law and capable in another. We did a legal ethics session a while back on marriage. And that's, you know, one area where this comes up. Someone may lack capacity for marriage, but have capacity in other areas. You're 100% right. And what we're seeing in the weight of the halachic authorities here is at least in the area of mitzvah observance, if not in other areas, being irrational in one area can really take them out of the picture in other areas as well. And mandate that we treat them differently. It's a very interesting thing, and it's going to be a major theme in the session on February 13th. We have a lot more to talk about in that regard. Yes, Dr. Libman, Bob.
So am I to understand that halachically, if you talk about your fellow who's having delusions about being Mashiach, he's naked, he's in a tree.
Yeah.
And he comes down from the tree, and he's going to, the Seder Kedushin is going to accept him.
Well, the case there was divorce. He can authorize the writing of a get, yeah.
How about a wedding?
If he can do one, he can do the other. Yeah. I mean, he doesn't have to come out of the tree in order to have the get written. He can do that from the tree. We're good with that. Dr. Libman, Esther.
Okay. My husband and I are actually on the same branch here. I thought it was a real chesed that Rabbi Feinstein is allowing this man to divorce his wife because he's clearly not normal. And if he's so abnormal, she is stuck with him. But if he is well enough to give her a get, then she escapes a person who is really quite incapacitated, actually.
Right.
I think, if you really do think you're Mashiach and not Mashiach. So it reminds me of how you're allowed to divorce your wife if she burns toast. Like, it actually gives you an ability to end a marriage for perhaps other reasons, but it allows you an out.
Right.
If there is need for an out of marriage. So I looked at that as a very specific thing, because I think clearly we would think we wouldn't want him to be a pilot or any other thing in life, because if he thinks he's a chef. But yeah, we'll give him permission to divorce his wife. That looks like pure
hesitance
for the wife.
Right. So there's a lot to discuss. And in the February 13th session, I really should take up this particular responsum at greater length and to ask the question, is this a leniency for an aguna, or is this something that can be replicated in non-aguna circumstances? It's worth exploring this one more, I think. Okay.
Regardless, in the wife's case, it's mekach shtu, so it doesn't matter.
But mekach tos, mekach shtus also, but yeah. Yeah. So the question there is a very interesting one that's beyond the scope of our discussion here, and that is, in the event that the doctor says that whatever disorder the husband is suffering from was there at the time of the marriage but wasn't known, can that be grounds for nullifying the marriage, for get needing divorce? It's a great discussion, but way beyond the scope of what we're doing this evening. Okay. So let's turn to that first vignette that I mentioned, in which we said, in light of, like, that 2008 study and other studies that have been done, that suggests that there is greater prevalence in the Jewish community. What should doctors be aware of in terms of the potential influence Judaism and the Jewish community have on the development and mitigation of eating disorders? So there's a lot that's been written over the years suggesting that we have, in fact, a special problem in our Jewish community. Not unique, but special here. And perhaps even in the observant community, separate from the problem that all human beings are facing. There was an article in the New York Times in 2011, and I gave you the link for it there in source number 34, in which the writer notes that the article is titled Rabbis Sound an Alarm Over Eating Disorders. Israeli studies consistently find high rates of disordered eating among Jewish adolescents, but not Arab ones. And Israel's rate of dieting is among the highest in the world, more than one woman in four, though obesity rates are relatively low. Data about American Jews is limited, but two small studies have reported high rates of disordered eating in certain communities. One of those, the 1996 study of an Orthodox high school in Brooklyn, found one in 19 girls had an eating disorder, about 50% higher than in the general population at the time. The 1996 study was done with the agreement that would not be published. The other study, done in 2008, that's the one we mentioned before, 868 Jewish and non-Jewish high school students in Toronto and found that 25% of the Jewish girls versus 18% of the non-Jewish girls. Demand for treatment programs that accommodate Orthodox teenagers prompted the Renfrew Center to start offering kosher food at its clinics in Philadelphia, New York, Dallas, and Florida, while a new residential facility catering to young women from the United States opened last year in Jerusalem, not affiliated with Renfrew. I gave you, in number 35, links to three more articles, one from the OU from Dr. Judith Rabinor, written in 2013, one from Tablet, Michael Orbach, writing in 2012, and one from a website, Eating Disorder Therapy LA, Dr. Lauren Molheim, in 2015. I disagree with some of what she wrote there, but you can read the article yourself. There are things to debate in the studies. Dr. Altman, who I mentioned earlier, disagrees with some of the points that are made using these studies, arguing that certain factors might skew study results somewhat, such as the socioeconomic character of the Jewish community that's being compared to the non-Jewish community in certain cases, using communities that have larger Jewish representation versus communities with a smaller Jewish representation. But she acknowledges there is an issue in the Jewish community, and some argue that it's an issue in the Orthodox community in particular. If you take a look at source number 36 from the National Eating Disorders Association in the U.S., where they point out certain concerns. I just looked at the time. I'm going to sum up what it says in number 36. Number one, they point out that stigma for mental illness causes it not to be acknowledged and therefore not to be treated in the observant community. Concerns for a shidduch will sometimes drive women to an eating disorder in a search for control, and I've heard that claim quite a bit. And it can be considered a more socially acceptable coping mechanism for dealing with stress than drug use or something like that, and therefore, people may go there. So I want to break down the discussion into a few areas. First of all, risk factors that are unique to the Jewish community or the observant Jewish community, then unique treatment needs of the Jewish community or the observant Jewish community, and finally, how Judaism and the Jewish community can help with treatment. So the general risk factors that are identified for eating disorders, if you take a look at number 37, is a broad, broad range. Biological risk factors, genetic, hormonal, chemical imbalance, right? Genetic presumably could be an issue within Jewish communities, right? We have genetic diseases. History, is there a previous eating disorder? Is there a history of substance abuse? Struggles with obesity or trauma issues? Sometimes there are risk factors that are psychological, low self-esteem, difficulty coping with stress, anxiety, low self-esteem, I put on twice, that's interesting. Perfectionism is a big one. Interpersonal issues, family relationships, low parental contact, high parental expectations, the two can sometimes go together. Criticism from others regarding their eating or their body shape, difficulty expressing emotions, a history of emotional or sexual abuse, pressure, occupational pressure, recreational pressure, cultural issues, peer pressure, a focus on beauty and thinness in the culture. It's really important to recognize, and Rabbi Rothwax does a nice job in his presentations emphasizing this, that a person can have all of these factors and not develop an eating disorder. And a person can have one of them or none of them and develop an eating disorder. He talks about, I think he called it the loaded gun theory, that some people are predisposed and then one of these things can trigger it. It reminded me of something that I pointed out when we talked about OCD. I don't know, it's about 10 years ago, but take a look at source number 38 from The Doubting Disease, Joseph Sirochi, who's talking about what triggers OCD and whether there's an issue of it specifically in religious communities. And I'm going to jump to the middle of the paragraph where it's starting with the word religion. Religion does not cause scrupulosity any more than teaching someone French history causes him to believe he is Napoleon. All human beings exist in some cultural context. Cultural backgrounds provide the scenery around which emotional problems create the drama. So his point is to say that you can't make the statement that because something manifests in terms of religion, religion was the cause. And he's talking about OCD as an issue there. And I'm applying that to say more broadly, the fact that it shows up in a particular context related to a particular thing doesn't mean that that was the cause. It could be that that's the trigger, but there was an underlying cause that brought the person there. So let's apply this to the Jewish community. First of all, the push for perfectionism is inherent in Judaism, and it's very often reinforced by well-meaning parents. I see people signing in. Please do make sure that you sign in. Thank you for the reminder. We have a strong push for perfectionism within our community. I gave you source number 40, which speaks to it, but I'm going to say it outside of the text at this point. The regulations that we have surrounding the body can, in fact, lead to shame. Gender expectations can lead to somebody feeling a need for control. We have a focus on physical beauty. Within Judaism, we do. Right? The descriptions in the Torah of the beauty of Sarah, Rachel, Yosef, Esther, the Talmud talking about how the matriarchs were beautiful. In our mitzvot, we try to use beautiful items and perform mitzvot in beautiful ways. It is true that we also have opposition sources that say you're not supposed to admire physical beauty. And we can quote sources, you know, from today until tomorrow in that regard. Nonetheless, beauty is a thing within Judaism. It's something that people do focus on. And as was noted in the plenary from 2010 that I linked in the beginning of the source sheet, anorexics will sometimes find communal support for what they're doing because people are going to walk up to them in shul and say, oh, you look great, not recognizing what they're reinforcing. Another risk factor that gets mentioned sometimes, larger families. I'm not telling people they shouldn't have large families, but you have to be able to pay attention to each child. That's not easy. We spotlight food in Judaism, right? Shabbos, Yom Tov, Kiddush, smorgasbord at a wedding. There is the phenomenon of new delicacies and recipes making the rounds, right? Rabbi Rothwax in one of his sessions calls it the foodie phenomenon. You know, I get questions all the time. What blessing do you make on this brand new thing? How do you kosher or tovel this brand new piece of equipment? Can you do sous vide on Shabbos? I'm not criticizing people who are enjoying food, right? And I'm not trying to take all the joy out of Judaism. But I'm saying that if we're that focused on food, you highlight it, you run a risk. And then you have the rules that we have that around eating that encourage control. Kashrus, brachos, fast days. They encourage us to think in terms of controlling our eating. That's source number 40 for those who are following it. And then you have the stigma surrounding acknowledging mental illness, right? We are a small community, even in Toronto, we are a small community. And there's a lot of fear of people finding stuff out about us, and therefore we don't want to talk about it. We don't even want to deal with it. Our role models from the Torah are painted as being perfect. They had no flaws. So if I have a flaw, there's something wrong with me. We have a lot of pressure to succeed in school, to impress parents academically. That, again, contributes to stigma if things aren't working out well. And the ever-present shidduch, fears and pressures, are a big part of it as well. All of this creates stigma, and shidduch is really its own topic, which I noted in number 42, if you're following along with the sheet. So there are a lot of reasons why the Jewish community can be vulnerable to this, and there are triggers here. There are also unique treatment needs in the observant Jewish community. There's a need for communication between the medical team and the rabbi to help anticipate issues and address them, easing the family's fears along the way. It's a really good thing if the treatment team can be ortho-friendly and educated about Judaism so that they'll understand how these aspects of Jewish life are part of the patient's mental landscape, and they can anticipate issues and threats that are coming up, and they can use language that is sensitive to observance. So I think that's something that's, you know, sort of important to note in its own right. But it's not all doom and gloom for the Jewish community. Judaism and the Jewish community can also help with treatment. I brought you on the sheet. Where is this? Yeah, I brought you on the sheet in source number 43, a paper, Spirituality Among Young Women at Risk for Eating Disorders. And this is a very interesting paper from the journal Eating Behaviors. And it argues that spiritual and religious beliefs and practices can help to cope with body dissatisfaction. That's something that's really, really important. We should not look at Judaism as a weakness and a source of harm when there's so much in it that can actually be helpful. That's number one. Number two, and I realize I'm kind of monologuing now, and I would love to be able to get feedback, but it's also 12 minutes left. The community support can be very, very helpful. Looking out for people and engaging them can help to reinforce a sense of self-worth. The way we talk matters a lot. We need to be sensitive to avoid harmful speech. I can't tell you how many times I have heard a rabbi speaking and mention OCD in a very cavalier way, right? Especially around Pesach. It's just like, no, you can't do that. It's the wrong message. I once heard a rabbi who I actually greatly respect mock validation. As a psychological concept, the importance of validating. Validating can be overused, but it's really, really important. It's empathy in another, you know, just another word for empathy. We need to realize that an apparently benign comment which won't affect most people may well affect the person in front of you. On the other hand, there are positives that we can be doing. Normalizing the language of psychology in the community is very important. You know, the same way that, you know, I'm going to say rabbi because that's, you know, my first name. The same way that a rabbi can tell people it's a good thing to go to a class, it's a good thing to get up early for minyan, it's a good thing to pursue therapy. Because what we really want in the end is that somebody who actually needs it goes before things become dire, you know, and doesn't push it off and say, well, you know what, I'll keep an eye on it. Don't keep an eye on it. Go to a professional now. Yeah, that's really vital. Rabbi Rothwax, in one of his sessions, quoted from a parent's letter to the community when her daughter was coming back to shul. Her daughter had an eating disorder and was coming back to shul, and they wrote a letter to the, you know, an open letter to the community. And one of the things they said was, don't appear to be walking on eggshells. Yeah, you do want to engage them and have a conversation. Say things like, I've missed you, not in a way that makes them feel guilty, right? That's not where you want to go with it, but I've missed you in a positive way. Share what's going on in your life if they want to listen. If the eating disorder comes up, admit you can't understand what she's going through. Do not offer food. Do not say you look great. That's not helpful. There's more. I recommend, again, his recordings. It's 8:51. What I want to do, I really want to get comments on this. So what I want to do is just very quickly address vignettes 2, 3, 4, just al regalachas on one foot, and then come back to the Jewish community piece of it. I hope that that's okay. The sources from vignette 2 through the end are all in Hebrew, except for one where I had done a translation, just because I ran out of time. You know, I sent the sheet out after midnight last night, and it wasn't my last email of the night. But in terms of fasting, the fasts other than Yom Kippur, so there what we say is, and there's great material in Rabbi Rosenzweig's book on this from contemporary halachic authorities, an anorexic should not fast on the fasts other than Yom Kippur, even if they're currently eating all right, so long as they are experiencing the thoughts in ways that threaten their health. They should not be fasting the rabbinic fasts, first of all, because they're rabbinic. Second, because of the danger that this fast is going to put them back in the headspace of their obsessive thoughts, or push them to respond to those thoughts in unhealthy ways. And because they may be exempt from mitzvot as a shota. So they really shouldn't be doing it. The bulimic should be in consultation with the doctor and the rabbi. Bulimia is less clear than anorexia. What about Yom Kippur? So we have great precedent in Judaism for feeding a patient who is dangerously ill on Yom Kippur. There is, generally speaking, the idea of working with doctors to feed the patient small amounts. However, that may not be appropriate and is often not appropriate for somebody who is an anorexic. You got into this trouble because of their control that they're trying to exert over their eating. You're reinforcing that by telling them, eat only this small amount and only over this period of time. It can actually make things much, much worse. And Rabbi Rosenzweig in his Nafshi B'Sheilati quotes quite a bit regarding this issue. In the journal Tchumen, there's a great article by Rabbi Dr. Tomer Mevorach, who gives three more reasons not to say, we'll only eat minimal amounts. He points out, first of all, you need a certain caloric intake in order to support weight for somebody who's been dealing with anorexia. Trying to feed the amount that person needs on that kind of a schedule of every 10 minutes or whatever it is, a small amount, is going to become the full day's process. And it's hard enough to feed such a patient in the ways that are necessary. So we generally assume if there's a risk for this patient, we do not work with shiurim, with minimal amounts of food. We feed them normally. If they've been treated and they're not yet stable, or doctors feel like fasting could harm them, or they themselves sense some disturbance from it, they should not fast. Maybe they should eat certain amounts. Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein seems to think so. Others absolutely disagree. Rav Nachum Rabinovich, Alav Ashalom, disagreed. If they're already in a stable situation, then and they have a track record of being all right and having an equilibrium, so consult with the doctor, consult with the rabbi, and figure it out. Maybe then it's something that they can manage. One thing that does get stressed, and I brought it on the sheet, I felt it was very important. It was in source number 50. Rabbi Rosenzweig makes the point, and it's very true, that eating can also be bad for them because it causes them to feel that they have failed, and it damages their sense of themselves, and it takes them out of the community. So sometimes fasting with the community is actually therapeutic. It's tricky in that regard. You have to be sensitive and careful. What about mitzvot of eating? That was vignette number 3, was the matzah question. So for somebody who is anorexic, some say that there is no obligation for them to eat matzah. They are considered to be ill, and therefore they're exempt from the mitzvah. And in fact, eating might even be inappropriate because it's called achila gasa in halacha. It's an eating they're not doing because they want to eat at all. They're just being coerced into it. Others disagree and say that that they can eat, and if it will be therapeutic for them, they should do so. If it's considered therapeutic, Rabbi Willig makes that point. And even with a bracha. The answer is, basically, I'm rushing too much to get through this point, so I'm just going to say, you know, consult a halachic authority on the matzah question and the general issue of a bracha on food when one is eating because one is told that they have to. The last item I wanted to mention, and then I'll come back to the Jewish community, is vignette number 4 and the issue of body image. And the vignette that I gave on the sheet was about, I'll read it out, 7 years after her anorexia diagnosis, Sarah is engaged to be married. Her diet is stable due to hard work, excellent counseling, and family support. But as part of her wedding plan, Sarah needs to go to the mikveh, which involves self-examination of her body to remove any chatzitzot beforehand. Before going to mikveh, you have to make sure the skin is all clean. The idea of examining herself unclothed induces panic attacks and flashbacks for Sarah. What options does she have? This is a loaded, very difficult question, and I brought it primarily so that I could highlight what Rabbi Rosenzweig brings in the last source on the sheet, number 52, where we're not answering the question of, you know, how to handle examination pre-mikvah, but just pointing out that for somebody who has been dealing with eating disorders, who has the challenges of body image and how looking at themselves in the mirror can actually be a painful and traumatic experience for them, a rabbi who's going to answer questions about what they need to do, what they don't need to do, has to keep that in mind. It's not one of the obvious things like fasting and eating matzah, but body image is another casualty that that has to be taken into consideration when dealing with eating disorders. Okay, thank you very, very much, everybody. And I would now like to ask for questions and comments on the Jewish community part, the general part. Go right ahead, please. I'll let you know when it's 9 o'clock and you can therefore log out if you want. I'll stick on around after that. Yeah. Ellen.
Yeah, so, you know, we talked about early detection and treatment, which are great, but you touched also on risk factors. But the one about shiduchim was all from sort of the girl's point of view. I think I'd really like to hear something about the shidduch b'shadchan and the shidduch websites and the shidduch organizations, because they are horrible at this stuff. There was one organization in Israel that told the girls, I don't want just a picture of your head. We don't want any surprises for our young men. We want a full body picture.
Wow.
I mean, this stuff is horrendous. It's not just one incident. This is over and over again.
I believe you. And I believe you because I've read so many articles that highlight this, both in the eating disorder discussion and in general discussions. You know, when I was in that parsha, there were no shidduch resumes in my circles. It was something I learned about afterwards. And then I learned about people asking questions like, what color tablecloth does your family use on Shabbos? But this business of needing a picture of the whole person, it's revolting. It's revolting. It's the wrong set of values having nothing to do with eating disorders. And the eating disorders makes it, you know, all the more problematic. I'm not pretending that physical attraction is not an issue for couples. Physical attraction is an issue for couples. But there's got to be a better way than some of the things that I've seen written up and the strategies that they use. And it's downright dangerous. And it may be not dangerous for 99 out of 100, but for 1 out of 100, it's just catastrophic. Agreed. I saw a hand up before you. Leah.
Yeah, I just actually wanted to follow up with that. I was thinking along the same lines, but where did this idea of extreme thinness is beauty develop in the yeshiva boys? Like, this seems to be that the shadchanim are doing what my impression is, this is what the boys tend to like, and is it being reinforced by their rebbes, and can the rebbes do anything about it? Like, I just want to know where it came from, and who's reinforcing it, and can it be dealt with from that aspect?
So it's a good question. It's definitely not coming from the rabbis. As someone who was in yeshiva, no rabbi ever conveyed that this was in any shape or form, no pun intended, something to seek or to value in any way, and just the opposite. They talk about, you know, not looking for that. Well, that, again, without denying that physical attraction affects people, but they didn't feel the need ever, that I ever heard, to speak to encourage that. Like, you should be looking for. It's not that. I think that part of it is the general culture we live in. People might pretend people might pretend to be ignoring the billboards and the bus stops and the magazine covers, but reality is that people see it and are a part of the society that we live in. And I think that's a huge issue. And I think it's a lot of it is peer group. I think they get it from each other and they get it from older brothers and they get it, in that way. They're not immune. Even somebody who lives in a society where they're not going to be watching a movie sees the side of a bus where the poster is there. They see what's held up as beauty. That's a reality, and I don't think that's something that's avoidable either. Someone give me something positive to end on.
If you'll forgive one very bad joke in very bad taste.
Should I turn off the recording first? Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm willing to be quoted.
Okay.
I think this is a conspiracy of the mothers for there to be infertility for 2 years while they're getting used to each other.
Aye. Yeah, no, that was bad taste. Thanks.
Told you so.
But the one thing that I would say that I think is important to highlight is that, again, source number 5, there are treatment modalities. There is evidence-based treatment for it. And as I said before, and I saw the notes in the chat from a couple of the doctors when I said it, don't say we're going to monitor this and watch where it goes. Get the treatment earlier. It is much more effective. Worst comes to worst, the doctor says to you, this isn't something to worry about. That's wonderful. If the doctor says to you, this isn't something to worry about, you got to get out of jail free card. That's great. But ask the question first. That, I think, is very crucial. Thank you very, very much, everyone. I'll stick around for a couple of minutes.
I just have one thing.